This week on the Fraternity Sorority Life podcast, we welcome in Todd Henry, author, speaker, and founder of The Accidental Creative, for a conversation about being healthy and productive.
We need disciplines, we need rhythms, we need practices, we need some things to ground us in who we are, in our biology, I think, you know, and help us understand better how we can approach our life and our work so that we're not going through those cycles of crash and burn like we do so often.
And what it means to truly love our work.
And most really productive contributors that I know, they don't love what they have to do all day, but they love the outcome that they're committed to. And they, in the big picture, they love their work because they love the outcome.
Hello, and welcome to the Fraternity Sorority Life podcast. I'm your host, Matt Deeg, and I'm excited to share today's conversation with you. I had the opportunity to sit down with Todd Henry, one of this year's AFA annual meeting keynote speakers, for a chat about his work and influences. Before we get to that conversation, knowing that the annual meeting is upon us and that folks are traveling to Fort Worth this week, I feel like it would be good to share a few tips and tricks to make the most out of our time together. First, be a part of the solution. Last week, Jess Gendron Williams with Fired Up shared an amazing blog that basically summed up all the feelings I've been having this past year. It's easy for us to get frustrated in our field, easy for us to turn and point the finger at others about hazing, about racism on our campus and in our organizations, about sexual violence, or about any number of things we see wrong in the field. But if we're not ready to show up and get down in the muck and work to push the cart out, we have no place engaging in the conversation. I love Teddy Roosevelt's comment, "It's not the critic who counts, it's the man in the arena." This year, let's all join in that arena and seek out solutions together. Two, don't assume that you have nothing left to learn. In our last episode, Ann Arsenault talked about how conference fatigue can set in for some of the more seasoned professionals in the fraternity sorority field. This simply can't be the case. There's always some new knowledge being created and shared. There are always new connections between topics and theories that you can make. If you find yourself flipping through the book thinking, none of this applies to me, pause, look back, and search for things that may challenge your thought processes or mental models. Sure, you may have advised sorority recruitment for 15 years, but that doesn't mean that your journey there has stopped. When we assume that we have nothing left to learn, we become stagnant. So come to the annual meeting searching for something new, a new perspective, a new insight, a new set of research to guide your work. Eric Hoffer said, "In times of change, learners inherit the world, while the learned remain beautifully equipped to deal with a world that no longer exists." I believe that we're in times of change in our fraternal world. Make sure you're positioned to help us move forward. Thirdly, pace yourself. I know, it's only 4 days, but those are some really long 4 days. Between the early mornings and all the late night gatherings, meals, and conversations, it can be easy to become overwhelmed with everything going on. So, just like we tell our students before UIFI or other leadership institutes, remember that it's a marathon, not a sprint. Do what you need to do to take care of yourself. Sleep, eat, take advantage of the early morning workout for a cause. Whatever it is, make sure that you can be present for the whole thing. Speaking as an introvert, by the time Sunday rolls around, I can't wait to put in some headphones and tune out everyone and everything. Part of this is due to my not following my own advice and just pushing myself through the whole week. But I always make sure to be present in conversation. And when I know I can't be, I take a short pause to recenter myself. Whichever side of the introvert-extrovert spectrum you fall, embrace that self-care. Fourth, meet someone new. I know, I love the annual meeting because I can find my friends, give them a big hug, and catch up. But remember, there are hundreds of people in our field and countless connections and new relationships that you can form. Don't just huddle up in your small groups. Remember what it was like for you as a newcomer or when your friends just couldn't make it to the meeting. Take the time and reach out to someone new during the networking breaks or at meals. We have an entire field built around people connecting with each other. This is the perfect space for us to do just that. Fifth and finally, enjoy the week. I always use the annual meeting as a time to recharge, recenter, and refocus on the work I'm doing. And I hope that you're able to as well. I'll see you in Fort Worth. If we connect, let's meet and chat. And now our guest for the day. Todd Henry teaches leaders and organizations how to establish practices that lead to everyday brilliance. He's the author of 3 books, The Accidental Creative, Die Empty, and Louder Than Words, which have been translated into more than a dozen languages,
and he speaks and consults across dozens of industries on creativity, leadership, and passion for work. His book, Die Empty, was named by Amazon.com as one of the best books of 2013. His latest book, Louder Than Words, is about how to develop an authentic voice that resonates and creates impact. Best-selling author Tom Rath called it one of the best guides to living a meaningful life I have ever read. Hello, Todd. Welcome and thanks for being on the show.
Thanks, Matthew. It's great to be here.
Awesome. I've enjoyed reading all your different books. Once I found out that you were going to be at the annual meeting, I was like, I'm going to grab all three and buy them. So I read them all back to back. They all hit on a different topic, but throughout each of them, you see the theme of innovation and productivity through them. What makes that theme so appealing to you?
Well, first of all, it's appealing to me on a personal level because you've spent, the last 20 years of my life as a creative professional trying to figure out how do I deal with the pressure of having to make it up every day, having to solve problems, having to show up and turn nothing into something. On that front, I've been intensely interested in creative productivity for years and years and years, but also just, my experience working with creative professionals and sort of living within the struggles of that and leading, teams of creative professionals. I mean, just realizing that there really aren't a lot of good, there's not a lot of good advice out there that is well constructed as sort of systemic about how to be prolific, brilliant, and healthy, which is kind of what I think we should aim for. We want to be prolific. We want to do a lot of work. We want to be brilliant because we want our work to be good, of course, and do the best work we can do. But we also want to be able to do that sustainably over the long term. And I think that's the piece that's often missing, Matthew, when we talk about creative productivity. Everybody wants to talk about how to do great work and a lot of work. But people aren't talking about, are you going to be able to do this for years and years to come? Or are you going to burn out, crash and burn, and eventually settle into mediocrity? So that's really been what I've been obsessed with for years and years. And so the three books that you mentioned, The Accidental Creative, Die Empty, and Louder Than Words, they're kind of a trilogy, if you will, for creative pros. Anybody who has to go to work and solve problems every day, it's kind of a trilogy for them to structure their life and their work so that they can be prolific, brilliant, and healthy.
Yeah, I think that's really cool. When you talk about them as a trilogy, so I read them in the order that you wrote them. But I think I would start with The Accidental Creative and then jump to Louder Than Words to help put those things into action, and then move to Die Empty, because that was by far my favorite book. Just absolutely love books like that. Why do you think kind of this theme's been appealing to audiences? So, I recognize you wanting to be prolific, brilliant, and healthy. And I think there are a lot of folks in the field of higher education who burn out pretty quickly. So we're missing right. That kind of healthy piece. But why has this been so appealing to audiences? What are people looking for, do you think?
Well, I think we're trying to learn a new way of being human and a new way of working. Really, you just look at the last 10 years. I mean, 10 years ago, Twitter did not exist. 10 years ago, YouTube was in its infancy. 10 years ago, there was no such thing as Facebook. 10 years ago, email was the primary way that you communicated with other people if you needed something from them, in a work context. And even that at the time was considered overwhelming and intrusive, and now we have things like Slack, and obviously we have Twitter, and we have all of these ways that we are connected to other people 24/7. And so as a result, I think we're trying to learn fundamentally new ways of being human and fundamentally new ways of working. And I think it's kind of like if you give, you give a new toy to a kid, I think sometimes it takes them a while to figure out what they're supposed to do with it. And I think many of us are, in the workplace, we're kind of like kids with new toys. Wow, we can work all the time, 24/7, around the clock, wherever we are, we can just be working. And that's kind of the curse of being a creative professional, is that you never get to step away from your work. Your mind is always going 24/7. Doesn't matter. You can shut off your phone. You can, do whatever you want to try to step away from the noise, but your mind is always going. And so we need disciplines. We need rhythms. We need practices. We need some things to ground us in who we are and our biology, I think, and help us understand better how we can approach our life and our work so that we're not going through those cycles of crash and burn like we do so often. And that is such a common story now. It doesn't surprise me at all to hear, almost everybody goes through that cycle of crash and burn at some point in their life or their career. And the problem is, when they, you know, gear back up again, they never start quite where they left off. You know, there's always kind of a gearing back up you have to do after a bout of burnout. And I think that's profoundly sad.
Yeah, that's something, you know, one of the things that's fascinated me in the field. So this is, I'm entering kind of year seven and working in higher education, five as a full-time professional, and watching a bunch of my different colleagues that came in at the same time as me move off into other areas, because we can get burned out really easily. And so I think the message that you're sharing does resonate a lot. You know, we've moved from that productive economy, right, where people are creating cars and widgets and all of that, to that very much knowledge-based economy where you can be creating something at any given time. You don't have to be in your work. I mean, I'm having ideas at 10 o'clock at night about the work that I'm doing.
Right.
And, you know, how do we learn to shut that off? And so I absolutely love that.
Well, that's one of the struggles. I mean, like I mentioned, it's hard to shut your mind off. I have had to discipline myself with my family when I sit down at dinner at night. You know, if I'm working on a book, or if I have something I'm doing with a client or whatever, you know, there are times when in the past I have just not been present with my family. And it's funny because my son will ask, my middle son will ask, "Dad, are you working right now?" You know, because he can tell that I'm not really there. I'm not really engaged. And I am. I'm working at the dinner table. I'm not on my phone. I'm not on my laptop. I'm not overtly working, but my brain is chewing on something. And so I think, you know, that's a trap I've fallen into many times. And I think all of us fall into that. But we need to have healthy rhythms of tension and release. That, you know, that's how growth happens. That's how great ideas happen. You know, it's how we build muscle, right? I mean, if you think about it, just in the sort of rudimentary biological sense, you go to a gym, and if you're just, you know, if you don't put any weight on the machine and you're just, you know, pumping the bar up and down, you're not going to grow. There has to be tension there. There has to be something that pushes against you. And then there has to be release of that tension. And that's when the muscle repairs itself and grows. And I mean, the same principle applies emotionally, mentally, creatively. We need tension, and we also need release.
Yeah, I think just that ability to kind of relax and recenter yourself certainly is a message that everybody needs, especially coming into fields that can really suck the life out of you, especially being a creative. In your book, Diempty, you describe three different forms of work: mapping, making, and meshing. Could you describe each of those and how they play a role in us being our best selves and unleashing our best work?
Sure. Yeah. So mapping is what we would kind of think of as strategy or planning. These are the three kinds of work that we do, by the way. Most of us think only of the first two kinds. Mm-hmm. We think of mapping, which is planning, it's strategy, it's making a task list, it's determining your course of action, which is important, and we have to do that. And then we think of the second kind, which is making, or we could call it execution. So that's doing the things that we plan. So we map and we make. We map and we make. And this is how most of us think of work. I plan and I do. And if you go to any, you know, high level organizational theory class, they will tell you there are two arms of any organization: strategy and execution. And that's basically mapping and making. It's what it is. But there's a third kind of work that we have to engage in if we want to be prolific, brilliant, and healthy, and if we want to unleash our best work. And it's the kind of work that we often ignore, especially when we're under pressure, especially when things get tense for us. And it's what I call meshing. And meshing is the work between the work. It's the little things that you do that set you up to be successful. Things like identifying your productive passion. Things like figuring out what is the compelling why behind the work, or what is the through line for these things that we're doing. You can plan and strategize all you want, and you can be very efficient at strategizing and executing. But if you're executing against the wrong core through line or the wrong core compelling why, then your work is ultimately going to be hollow and meaningless. So that's one example of meshing. Another one is growing yourself, you know, sharpening your mind, developing new skills, having important conversations with the people on your team that aren't necessarily related to the work, but more related to how you're doing the work, or how people are perceiving how the work is being done. You know, it's things like, you know, staying connected to other people in your life who can speak truth to you and help you stay aligned and sharpened. These are the kinds of things that go away, Matthew, when we're under pressure. These are the things that seem like the non-essentials, which is why we don't do them. And so people map and they make, they map and they make, they map and they make. And these are people I call drivers. And over the course of time, drivers become decreasingly effective because they're not doing those little things that they perceive to be irrelevant when they're under pressure. Instead, they'd rather just squeeze out a little bit more work, you know, plan and do. But in so doing, they're unfortunately often squeezing out all of the beauty and the effectiveness and the true value they have to contribute because they're not taking the time to develop themselves and develop their mindset and develop their productive passion and stay connected and stay aligned in all these little things.
Yeah, it sounds like, you know, when you talk about that, I think about just meshing being kind of that foundation for the work that we do, right? Without meshing, the other two, mapping and making, are very much, they can be very aimless, right? And so the entire point of Die Empty is unleashing your best work and making sure that, you know, you are being the productive professional that you want to be. And so meshing allows for you to gain those skills, but then also really know what you want to accomplish with your life instead of just kind of bouncing from task to task to task, which can allow for burnout and for kind of aimlessness. And that's one of the seven deadly sins that you mentioned. You know, as I was reading through that, I was thinking about just our educators in the field that I work in. And I think probably the specific ones, you mentioned seven deadly sins in a nice alphabetical order, which makes them easier to remember. I appreciate that.
They were not originally in that form, by the way. People ask me all the time, you know, did you sit around and try to come up with a C and a D? No, absolutely not. I mean, originally, the final one is guardedness. And originally, that was isolation was the original word. So, you know, I sort of had to try to figure out a way to work these concepts into a framework that was more memorable. But
yeah, yeah. But, you know, those are ways that we can easily remember them. But as I was thinking about this, the top three that I really thought that we kind of have in higher education are aimlessness, delusion, and fear. Mm. And I was curious if you had some advice or thoughts for educators working to overcome those in themselves.
Yeah, so aimlessness doesn't mean you don't know what you're doing. I mean, most of us as professionals, we have a general sense of the projects we're doing, right, the kinds of things we're accountable for. Aimlessness is a little bit more difficult to discern because what it really means is that you lack a through line. You lack a sense of why in your work. You lack a productive passion, an outcome that you're committed to. Now, this word passion, we often toss around as if it's, you know, it means something that I love doing or something I have a sort of an interest in that just flames up and I can't control it. And we often even throw around things, you know, phrases that I think are really dangerous phrases, especially for people who are maybe newer in their career. These phrases like, you know, if you find your passion, you will never work a day in your life and all that. I don't know about you. I feel like I'm operating within my productive passion, but I, quite frankly, many days do not want to do the work that I have to do in order to achieve the outcome that I love. It's not about loving the tasks. It's about loving the outcome you're committed to. And most really productive contributors that I know, they don't love what they have to do all day, but they love the outcome that they're committed to. And they, in the big picture, they love their work because they love the outcome that they achieve. It doesn't mean that they're going to love their tasks all day long. And that's, I think, a misunderstanding about work. And when we lack that compelling sense of a through line or that compelling productive passion, and that word passion, by the way, comes from the root word pati, which means to suffer. So, you know, it doesn't mean we have to suffer, but it means we're willing to suffer on behalf of something because we care so deeply about it. When we lack that, it causes us to drift. It causes us to lack a sense of cohesion within our work. And it also can cause us to take on work or make decisions or pursue projects that aren't leading us toward a common end. So one thing I would encourage people to do is just ask a very simple question. What is the outcome I'm trying to achieve with my work? Now, that might sound obvious. Well, I'm trying to do this project. Well, I'm trying to put on this thing. I'm trying to, you know, write this whatever. But it's usually not that simple. You have to take a couple of steps back and ask, what is the ultimate target that I'm shooting for? What is the ultimate end that I'm funneling my work toward? And then back up and ask, how does this project I'm working on tie into that productive passion, that through line, that outcome that I'm committed to? So that's how we begin to counter aimlessness. As humans, we are wired to derive a sense of meaning and value and purpose from the work that we do, even a sense of identity from the work that we create. And when we lack a clear and cohesive outcome that we're committed to, our work can feel very aimless, can feel very scattered. It feels like we're pushing a wall forward an inch at a time instead of making precise, focused progress on our goals. So that would be one very simple thing I would encourage people to do, is just step back and ask, what is the outcome I'm working toward, and how do all of these individual projects that I'm working on right now tie back to that through line, to that productive passion, that outcome that I'm trying to achieve? As far as delusion goes, I mean, this is really common in just about every sector, every organization I've worked in. We live with these false narratives, these narratives that tell us, this is who you are, this is who you aren't, here's what's possible, here's what's not possible. And many people come into an organization or any kind of an industry, and they hear these things and they assume, okay, well, somebody very smart must have figured this out a long time ago. And they never even challenge those assumptions. And so they live with these false narratives, these false ideas about what is and what isn't possible. Or worse, sometimes they hear things from people like, if you want to be valuable, you have to be one of those kind of people. You have to be a person who does this or who does that. And so they start emulating the things that they think they have to be in order to appease everyone around them. And in so doing, they turn their back on who they really are and the real value they have to contribute. And so they spend, maybe some people spend years trying to be something they're not. And as a result, they never see the contribution, the value they're uniquely capable of contributing. So I think what we have to do is step back and ask the question, what am I doing right now that doesn't seem like me? Is there anything in my life that I'm trying to do because someone else has layered an expectation upon me, but maybe that's not truly reflective of the value that I have to contribute? So that would be, you know, another thing I would encourage people to do. And then the final one you mentioned is fear. And, you know, this is when the perceived consequences of failure outweigh the perceived benefits of success. So we don't act. We don't take little strategic risks that eventually lead to great breakthroughs in our work. We huddle close to the middle. There comes a point, Matthew, when it's easier to protect the ground you've taken than to take new ground. It's easier just to circle the wagons. And we see this in a lot of industries. This is when organizations start going downhill. It's when they start circling the wagons and kind of protecting the ground they've taken. So, you know, one thing I encourage people to do is just on a daily basis, ask themselves, what am I afraid of right now? What am I afraid might happen? And to really do a gut check on, first of all, is that a likely outcome if I take this strategic risk? And then have a set of strategic risks that you take every day, or you know, ensure that you're taking strategic risks every day, I should say, that push you into uncomfortable places with your work, that challenge you to, you know, develop your voice and a unique way of approaching your work. There's a guy named Neil Fiore who wrote a book called The Now Habit, which is about countering procrastination. And he'll often he described this experiment where he'll put a wood plank on the floor and he'll ask people, could you walk the length of this plank if I ask you to? And they look at it like, you know, he's crazy. It's a wood plank on the floor. It's just a 10-foot long, 6-inch wide wood plank. Of course I could do that. And he'll say, now imagine I suspend that wood plank 100 feet in the air. Could you walk the length of that plank now? And they look at the imaginary plank and they look at him and say, no way. Are you kidding me? No way am I walking a wood plank 100 feet in the air. But I think that raises an interesting question, which is this: what has changed about the technical skill required to walk that plank? Absolutely nothing, right? If you can do it on the ground, you can do it in the air. What's changed are the perceived consequences of failure, which right. In this case is plummeting to your death. So I kind of get it, right? But I would submit to you, Matthew, that many professionals, especially creative professionals, because of the psychological pressure that we're under, we go through our days artificially escalating planks. artificially escalating the perceived consequences of failure to the point that we don't act. We don't try things. We don't take little strategic risks. Mm. So I would encourage people to ask, where am I artificially escalating planks? Where am I artificially escalating the perceived consequences of failure to the point that I am staying in my own little huddled corner and not taking strategic risks that could lead to great breakthroughs with my work?
Yeah, it sounds like kind of the thread running through all of those things is just this idea of really self-awareness. You know, when you talk about that aimlessness, I've been working with some of my student leaders to say, we're not going to focus on projects or tasks anymore, but we're going to focus on overarching themes for the work that we're doing, instead of just saying, okay, we accomplished this, check, move on, to help them to see like how everything can kind of move and mesh together. And then with delusion, the only thing I kept on thinking about was just this idea of mental models, right? Like, you know, we have these roadblocks that we set up in our minds that are assumptions or, you know, learned behaviors through the work that we've done that keep us. And so we need to be able to challenge those mental models and really continually re-examine them. And, you know, just that idea of self-awareness for professionals can certainly help to lead to better production, better creativity, better innovation, which is something that, you know, I know in our now knowledge creative economy is really what we need to be doing.
That's exactly right. And I think that self-awareness phrase is really a really solid one, because I do think that that's, you know, at the end of the day, I think that everything comes down to self-awareness, understanding where you're at your best, understanding how other people hear you and perceive you. I mean, my new book, Louder Than Words, is about, you know, your voice. And it's about how your voice isn't just what you say. It's how other people hear you. And I think often there's a big gap between what we think we're communicating or what we think we're saying or building or making and what other people actually perceive. And so self-awareness becomes really, really important if we want to have impact.
Yeah. And I thought, you know, you mentioned Louder Than Words, and I really, that book for me was all about self-awareness, right? Finding your authentic voice, and you at the beginning key into the three different elements, identity, vision, and mastery, and then kind of go on to talk about how we can develop each of those. Can you touch on them and why they matter a little bit?
Yeah. So, you know, I call these three the elements of the voice engine. They're sort of the drivers of how you develop your voice over time. And, you know, voice isn't, some people think, you know, you just wake up in the morning and you go out in the backyard and you dig up a box and suddenly I found my voice. and it doesn't happen that way. People who eventually navigate to their sweet spot, they navigate to the place where they're operating in a place where they are free and compelling and, you know, just really doing the work that they're wired to do that over time. And they do that by really developing three core, what I call, you know, drivers of the voice engine. The first one is identity, which is a sense of who you are. Who are you? What do you stand for? What do you care about? You know, what is your productive passion? What's the through line for your work? What is really the most compelling why for what you do? And some people never think about this, or they just adopt the compelling why of whatever organization they attach themselves to. And as a result, they never develop a core sense of authentic identity, which is really important. You know, the second driver of the voice engine is vision. And this is about where you're taking your work and where you're leading your intended audience. You're not just out there screaming in the woods, because that's ultimately fruitless. If you have something you care about, you want to see impact from that. So you have to develop a vision for your intended audience. Where do you want to take them? Where do you want them to go with you? And so you have to have a clear and compelling vision. Otherwise, you'll just be seen as, you know, not clear. Nobody will know, why is that person speaking to me? I don't understand. And then finally, after you, you know, develop identity and vision, you have to develop a sense of mastery of the unique skills that are required in order to be able to take that work into the world, which means developing and cultivating empathy, cultivating timing, cultivating a sense of you know, craft around whatever your unique mechanism of delivery of your work is, or else you won't be seen as credible. So you have to have that going for you as well. So identity, vision, mastery, these three things all kind of work together over time. And so as you develop a sense of identity, it helps sharpen your vision. And as you sharpen your vision, it helps you understand what skills you need to develop in order to deliver that work. And as you develop those skills, you learn more about yourself and about your identity and how you're wired. And so these things all kind of feed one another, and they become a virtuous upward cycle over time as you develop your voice.
Yeah, as you were saying that, I was thinking, boy, this sounds both linear and cyclical, right? Identity feeds into vision, vision feeds into mastery, mastery feeds back into identity. And, you know, you said it exactly what I was going to say is, you know, it's a, I like what you said, an upward spiral.
Right.
And that's just really fantastic. And towards the end, you get really practical in Louder Than Words about developing your voice and touch on really three core responsibilities. You know, I think we often just focus on, you know, we're responsible to ourselves, right? We want to have meaningful work, be authentic, all this stuff. But you touch on the fact that it's that there are stakeholders, self, and the work that we are responsible to. How do each of these play a role in helping us become more authentic?
Yeah. So, you know, you have, you know, you do have those three responsibilities to your stakeholders, the people who are paying you to do a job or who have asked you to do a job or people who are going to benefit from the job. Whatever it is you're doing, you know, these are your stakeholders and they have expectations of you and you have to balance those expectations. And sometimes those expectations may not line up with your own personal interests or your own personal preferences, you know, and so your second responsibility is to yourself, to listen to your intuition, to listen to your gut, to follow your intuition when you're doing your work. And this is really challenging, I think, for many people because, you know, they defer their interest for the sake of the stakeholders, you know, and they just kind of do whatever people tell them to do. But, you know, you have a responsibility to yourself to listen to your intuition and to follow your gut as it relates to the decisions that you make in your work. And then the third stakeholder you have, and this is kind of a little, you know, mystical and kind of woo-woo, so stay with me here, but it's to the work itself. Every project exists within a context. It doesn't exist in a vacuum. It exists within a context. And if you listen to the work, if you listen to the project, if you listen to the context, it will kind of tell you, this is kind of what I want to become, kind of where I want to go. And so you have a responsibility to the work or to the idea or to the, you know, the project itself. And so the challenge for a lot of creative pros is just balancing those three responsibilities. How do I balance the expectations of my stakeholders, the balance my own expectations of myself, and then balance what I'm thinking the work wants to become, you know, whether that's what I like or what the stakeholders like, this is kind of what the work wants to become. And so we have to just figure out how are we going to balance all three of those things. And really, that's kind of the tension that we live in as creative pros. It's constantly going back and forth between my stakeholders and my own intuition and what the work kind of wants to be. And you kind of live in that tension. And there's no easy solution to that, but we just have to recognize those three responsibilities so that in those moments when we're under pressure, we can notice, oh, wait a minute, I think that I'm actually just bowing to my own preferences at the expense of my stakeholders right now. Or I think I'm bowing to my stakeholders, or I think I'm, you know, just kind of following the work, but I'm not really listening to what my stakeholders and my intuition is telling me. So that's that. It just helps to know that those things exist so that we can you know, recognize those moments where we might be tempted to compromise under pressure.
Yeah, I think being able to navigate all three of those and to work within all three of them comes back to that theme of self-awareness, right? So knowing yourself and also knowing what the stakeholders want and see, and making sure that you align with those.
That's right.
You know, one of my friends a while ago shared with me a way to tell if you were really needed to stay at an organization. It was a threefold set of questions. You know, are you making them better? Are they making you better? And do you feel supported? And, you know, I think those three questions are really kind of woven into that idea of, you know, the responsibility to the stakeholders, your responsibility to yourself, and, you know, your responsibility to doing good work. I think all three of those questions get answered and kind of help to do that.
That's right. I agree completely.
You know, I know we're about ready to wrap up. And one of the things I know is that you are passionate about helping individuals create and produce work that matters and is excellent. Saw that in all of your work, and, you know, just the way that you do things with the collective and challenge people. So what final advice would you give to our listeners? Most of them are educational professionals. I've got some students that listen too. But what advice would you give to make this a reality, to help them create and produce work that matters and is excellent?
So this is kind of the main thing. I would ensure, if I were you, I would ensure that you're not getting lost in the details, that you're cultivating a sense of who you are and what you're trying to accomplish in the world, that you have a sense of what you're building and understand the outcome that you're committed to. And then as much as you are able, try to tie your daily work back to that outcome and be progressing toward that outcome. Now, that target might change over time, of course, but make sure that you're not losing sight of what you're ultimately trying to do when you're in the fray. Because if you do, you might spend days, weeks, months, years working on something. And then you look back and you say, what have I done? I have sold out what I perceived to be my own ambitions, my own ultimate objectives for the sake of a little bit of short-term gain. And that to me is the most sad thing I encounter in the marketplace are people who, to the outside world, they're celebrated, you know, maybe even a little bit successful at what they do, maybe even, you know, powerful within their organization, but they're deeply, deeply dissatisfied with their work. And they're just kind of, they're waiting to pull the ripcord on the golden parachute because they have built a life and a body of work that is not reflective of them. It's reflective of what everybody around them wanted. And so that would be my advice, is just make sure you're building your body of work, not somebody else's.
I love that. That's a great way to end this. Todd, thank you so much for taking the time with me. I look forward to seeing you in a couple of weeks at the annual meeting, and look forward to just listening and learning more from you.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much.
Thanks, Todd.
So that's our episode for the week. If you have comments or questions, hit me up on Twitter @MattD or comment in iTunes or on the blog. We'll be back in 3 weeks with a new episode focused on the DU AFA Global Service Initiative in Jamaica. Until then, stay curious.